could withstand a direct hit from an anti-tank missile. There were two security cameras visible on the property, one watching over the driveway to the right of the porch, the other pointing straight down to the front door to record anyone who approached. A tall wooden fence rimmed with barbed wire enclosed the small backyard, and an angry dog back there barked and snarled at any sound on the street. Cort blew into his hands again while he took in the scene. The inner city location, the beat-up house with the fortified access point, the rough-looking skinny white boys coming and going. There was no mystery as to what he was looking at. This was a stash house for a drug ring. 30 minutes after his run-in with the would-be muggers on 8th Street Southeast, Cort had seen a man selling packets of either heroin or meth behind a gas station on Savannah Avenue. Cort melted into the dark edge of the parking lot to watch, and soon he determined the man probably wasn't dealing H, because he looked like a meth head, which meant he was both a user and a dealer, and it stood to reason he used what he dealt. The bony man made a phone call after the sale. Cort wasn't in a position to hear any of it, but from the fact the man started walking as soon as he hung up, Cort thought he might be heading to a stash house to drop off money and pick up more supply. And Cort had been right. He followed the gaunt young man 7 blocks, finding this surprisingly difficult to do because the man was amped up and paranoid, always looking back over his shoulder, ducking down behind things, and even moving in and out through traffic racing by on Wheeler Road. But Cort kept the tail, because he knew the low-level dealer was going someplace Cort wanted to be. The man finally arrived at this single-story clappered house on Brandywine Street, where he knocked 4 times on the iron door, and then transferred something, almost certainly cash, through a slot at chest level, before receiving something, almost certainly drugs, in a paper bag. He headed off up the street, and Cort watched the man go, and soon another equally strung-out-looking white kid appeared and repeated the sequence, giving Cort all the evidence he needed that he'd come to the right place. Cort had considered making his way into a neighbor's backyard to get a better look at the property behind the stash house, but the angry pit bull snarling there encouraged him to change his mind. The dog went positively apeshit every time one of the men stepped onto the property to knock on the front door, so Cort decided he couldn't get any closer to the house without raising the alarm. Instead, he moved to the derelict asphalt-covered park, stood on the playground, and cased the location from the front, planning his next move. While he felt certain he knew what was inside the house, he had no idea who was inside the house. They could be MS-13, the Salvadoran gang, or they could be white supremacists. From the 3 motorcycles lined up and locked together on the drive, he knew they could be some biker gang as well, but the old beat-up bikes weren't nearly as impressive as Cort's mental image of what a biker gang would be riding, so he was betting against Hell's Angels or Outlaws MC. He was pretty sure who wasn't inside. There was a pickup truck in the drive, a late-model candy apple red Dodge Ram, and the presence of a rebel flag decal on the back window gave Cort the impression that the operation in the house probably wasn't conducted by the DC Blacks, the Crips, or the Bloods. But Cort didn't really care about the occupants themselves. All that really concerned him was the security of the property, because he planned on making entry on the house. He wanted to know about any booby traps, false access points, man traps, or other fortified areas. At this point, he wasn't really thinking about the presence of guns, because he knew there would be guns. No self-respecting drug dealer would operate in the United States without an arsenal within arm's reach. But to Cort, this was not a problem. In fact, he was counting on it. He checked his watch. 20 minutes till midnight. For a second, he considered hanging out there until 3 a.m., when the average person's body clock was at its lowest. But almost immediately, he decided against waiting. Meth heads kept weird hours, after all, and Cort knew they might well be more wired and ready at 4 a.m. than at 4 p.m., so he made the decision to act now. He left the darkness of the playground and stepped out onto the sidewalk. He didn't go directly to the stash house. Instead, he backtracked half a block, returning to an unlocked garage he had noticed as he was tailing the street dealer through the neighborhood. He entered the garage, felt his way around, and came across a pull cord for a lamp on a work table. Before he pulled the cord, he took off his jacket and threw it over the lamp so he could control the amount of light the bulb gave off. He pulled the chain and then moved his jacket so that only a faint glow reached the rest of the little one-car garage. He saw a few items on the table and a few more on a wooden shelf, and he took what he needed, turned off the lamp, and felt his way back to the exit. Minutes later, he crossed the street in front of the drug house, his hands empty and non-threatening. As he approached, he heard the sound of industrial heavy metal music coming from inside. He walked up the little driveway, past the bikes and the Dodge pickup, and climbed up onto the porch. By now, the frantic noise was blasting, which was impressive to Court, considering the windows were boarded and the door could not have been more secure. Looking the door over, he tried to determine the security measures at this entrance. There would be deadbolts and multiple chain locks, and there would be a drop bar or a dead man, a large metal shank that secured the door to the wall. Court knew he would not be entering through that door unless someone on the inside wanted him to, and he didn't see much of a chance in that. He banged four times, and the dog in the backyard barked like a maniac. Seconds later, a 4-inch-high and 12-inch-wide slit opened in the center of the door at chest height, firing a bolt of light across the porch. From the inside, Court heard the loud metal music, and above that, a voice high and harsh like a coffee grinder.
"What the fuck you want?"
Court leaned down to look into the slot. A bald-headed, shirtless man in his 30s stood back a few feet from the door. His chest and neck were tattooed and glistening with sweat. He held a lit cigarette in his left hand. Pure white trash. Court looked over the ink on the man's chest quickly. The numbers 1 and 2 rode high above his left pec. Court knew the significance. The numbers represented the first and second letters of the alphabet, AB. This asshole was Aryan Brotherhood. Court also noticed the man was hiding something in his right hand behind his thigh.
"I said, what do you want, fuckhead?"
"I need a hit."
Court was winging it. He didn't know the street lingo for meth these days. He'd been out of the States for several years and had never bought meth in his life. He saw the paranoia in the white supremacist's eyes now as the man realized this wasn't one of his regular street dealers. He said,
"Get lost!"
"Your guy told me to come here. He said he ran out of stuff."
"What guy?"
"Skinny dude over at the Exxon on Savannah."
A younger man stepped up behind the bald man at the door. He had stringy hair and was wearing a wife beater, and his arms were sleeved with shamrocks and the number 12. He also had 88 on his neck, and Court knew these numbers were representations of the 8th letter of the alphabet, HH.
Heil Hitler. Charming.
The younger man said,
"He's talking about Junior."
"Junior, that's right,"
Court confirmed helpfully. The bald-headed man reached back and punched the kid and the wife-beater in the chest, then shoved him out of Court's line of sight. He turned back to Court, his eyes wide with both suspicion and anger.
"Fuck you! Get off my porch!"
He moved his right hand from behind his hip and exposed a black AK-47 assault rifle with a folded stock. Court raised his hands.
"It's all good, brother. Hook me up and I'll go."
He pulled the wad of bills out of his pocket, the 10 wrapped around the 6 ones. He held it up but kept it moving in front of his face, hoping it looked like significantly more than $16.
"See, I've got cash."
"This ain't McDonald's drive-thru, you stupid fuck! Get out of here!"
The man rushed to the door and slid the tiny panel shut. Court heard another male voice, different than that of the two men he'd already heard speak, and then a screaming female. Everyone was shouting over the music, but Court couldn't understand a word of what was being said. He hadn't really expected to be invited in for tea, or for any transaction to take place. This was a stash house, hardly an inviting retail establishment. He just wanted to use the opportunity to get a look at the inside, to judge the defenses, to evaluate the opposition. Four people in the front room, three males. He had seen just the one rifle, but he imagined each and every one of those drug-addled, paranoid freaks inside would be carrying some sort of a weapon. He had told himself earlier that if he knew there were more than three people inside, he would move on, find another target of opportunity. But it was getting late. He was getting cold. And four was close enough to three. He'd continue on with his mission here. Just to get everyone inside a little more jumpy and overwrought, he knocked again.
"I'm going to kill you!"
the bald-headed man shouted, and then, for added emphasis, he added a,
"Fuck off!"
Court heaved a big sigh. He gave a light,
"Have a good night,"
and he turned and left the porch. But he did not return to the sidewalk or the street. Instead, he walked over to the driveway and looked up at the camera peering down at him. It was on the side of the house, just under the awning, a foot and a half out of Court's reach. Its lens was centered on the Dodge Ram and the motorcycles. Court moved to the side of the Ram, and as he did so, he reached into his blazer and pulled a hammer from his waistband, an oily shop rag, and a lighter from his pocket. He used the claw of the hammer to pry open the fuel door of the vehicle. Then he removed the fuel cap and stuffed the oily rag most of the way in the fueling tube. He lit it quickly. Court stepped directly under the camera now and tossed the hammer up gently. It hit the camera and knocked the lens so that it pointed up to the rainy sky. Court caught the hammer as it fell. Then he moved up the driveway towards the back gate, but while doing so, he turned around and heaved the hammer overhand into the windshield of the Ram. The glass cracked, and the vehicle's shrill alarm began to wail. Chapter 6 Two men armed with 12-gauge shotguns raced out the back door of the single-story clapboard house, leapt off the side of the porch, and then charged to the locked gate that led to the driveway. One of the men slowed to release a 90-pound pit bull from his chain, freeing him to run with the humans towards the noise in the front of the property and the man who had caused it. At the gate, one man unhooked a large loose padlock from the staple hasp on the wooden fence, then kicked the gate open, his shotgun at the high ready in case someone stood waiting for him there. The dog took off up the driveway, and when the man saw no one in front of him, he ran towards the Dodge pickup to douse the flames licking up the side panel of the truck bed. The second man followed close behind the first, himself waving his 12-gauge in all directions as he did so. He saw the flaming rag in the gas tank of the Dodge Ram, and he hesitated a moment, not knowing if it would explode at any second. But his colleague was either braver or more foolish, and he charged at the flames, desperate to save the vehicle. Court Gentry knelt in the bushes next to the gate and watched the pit bull bolt from the darkened backyard. The massive black form of muscle and gnashing teeth raced past Court's position on his way to freedom. Behind the pit, two men, both rail thin and pasty white, sprinted through the gate, down the driveway, and towards the Dodge Ram, wooden-stocked shotguns out in front of them. One man slowed for a moment, hesitating, but soon enough he headed on, catching up with his friend at the burning shop rag. Court slipped into the backyard and closed the gate behind him, locking it by dropping the padlock's shackle through the hasp. There was no direct lighting back there at all, but the tiny bit of residual glow from the raining sky above gave him a dim view of his surroundings. The entire yard was surrounded by the 10-foot-high privacy fence. It was overgrown and filled with trash, and a broken-down and weed-covered Chevy Monte Carlo was on blocks alongside the fence near the back porch. The windows of the house back there were boarded, just as they were out front, and the back door was a metal and plexiglass storm door. As Court moved past the car, he pulled an old, shredded tire out of the weeds. It was only a small-sized spare, but it must have weighed 20 pounds. His injured right forearm hurt when he held that much weight in his right hand, so he hefted it in his left and continued on towards the porch. As he started up the stairs, he stopped suddenly. Something about the scene triggered a sense of danger. He figured it out quickly. It was odd there were no bright lights back here. It would have made sense considering the other security measures on the property, unless, of course, the back entrance was booby-trapped. Court still had the lighter, so he fired it up and held it out, and immediately he saw the glint of metal suspended 2 feet in front of his face. A dozen or more large metal fish hooks hung on fishing line 5.5 feet off the ground, at eye level of the average man. The thin filament was attached to the columns on either side of the steps up to the back porch, and the hooks hung ready to dig into the face and rip out the eyes of anyone unaware of this security measure. Obviously, those who lived or worked in the stash house also knew to avoid the stairs of the back porch and instead to come and go by stepping up onto the 2-foot-high porch on either side of the stairs. Court saw a milk crate positioned to his right to help with that, so he sidestepped the booby trap and climbed up the rest of the way to the door. He heard shouting and barking in the driveway now, and the gate rattled off to his left. Court assumed the Aryan Brotherhood men and their Nazi dog had just figured out they'd been tricked. As he made to reach for the handle of the heavy black door, light engulfed the porch and the door flew open. A man appeared in the doorway, backlit from a bulb in the room behind him, a Kalashnikov rifle held high. Court rushed forward, batted the weapon to the side with his right hand, and banged the 20-pound rubber tire into the man's face with his left, striking him in the jaw, snapping the man's head back, and knocking him to the floor. Court entered the house by stepping over the dazed man, and he closed and locked the metal door behind him. He found himself in a poorly lit, dark-paneled hallway floored with cheap linoleum. The thick smell of cigarette smoke, pot, and rotting garbage assaulted his nostrils and clawed at his eyes, and the incessant music, played at a volume that made Court think of a concert in hell, further disrupted his senses. He started to kneel to pick up the AK, but before he could get his hand on the weapon, another man raced in through a dim doorway ahead and to his left on his way towards the back door. This man also wielded a Kalashnikov, but he had not expected to see a threat inside the house, so his weapon was not up and ready to fire. Court identified this man as the young Aryan Brotherhood member with the 88 on his neck. As the man raised his gun towards the stranger, Court swung the car tire at him underhanded, and it slammed into his face with a thud audible over the hammering drumbeat of the heavy metal. The young man's head flew back, banged against the door casing. He slid down, unconscious, and flat on his back on the hallway floor. The Aryan Brotherhood man by the back door, who had taken the tire to the jaw, rolled slowly to his knees and reached for his weapon, but Court kicked him in his already bloody face and spun him into the air, dropping him against the locked back door. Court lifted one of the AKs off the ground now, but as he did so, a shrill scream caused him to look back over his shoulder. Down the full length of the paneled hallway, some 25 feet away, a woman held something over her head. Court recognized the item immediately, although he could not help but recoil in surprise. It was a katana, a traditional Japanese sword. Not good. And it got worse. Court realized the sword was being brandished by a meth head. The woman might have been in her 20s or 30s, but her skin was dry and leathery and stretched across the bones of her pockmarked face, and every exposed inch of her arms and neck was covered in scabs and tats. Her white blonde hair was oily and thin, and the black t-shirt and jeans she wore were torn and threadbare. He was as afraid of the woman as he was of the deadly weapon in her grasp. The meth head with the sword charged. She was no expert with this weapon of hers. Court determined this instantly. In the narrow hall, she should have been advancing forward with the point of the katana, but instead, she swung it from side to side, slamming the blade into both walls as she closed wildly. Court did not see her any differently because she was a woman. Any sense of chivalry or gender bias in a force-on-force encounter had been trained out of him years and years ago. He saw her only as a threat, a target. He brought the AK up to his shoulder, used his thumb to make sure the fire selector was set to semi-automatic, centered the blade sight on her chest, and moved his finger to the trigger. But before he could press the trigger and drop the woman, fully automatic gunfire erupted somewhere in the house. Suddenly, jagged perforations pocked the paneling of the hallway, waist high, halfway between Court and the charging woman with the sword. Though the holes appeared in both sides of the hall, Court could tell the shooting was coming from his right, so he dropped down onto his left shoulder, landing on the cold linoleum, and he returned fire with his AK, sending rounds of lead back into the direction of the gunfire, shooting through the wall next to him. The woman with the sword made it less than halfway to Court before she was cut down. One of the bullets fired by the unseen attacker ripped through the paneling and then sliced through both of her thighs, causing her to stumble and fall awkwardly to her knees. The sword flew from her hands and clanged along the floor, then it slid, hilt first, all the way to Court. Court ignored the sword and kept firing the Kalashnikov at the wall just inches in front of him. The crushing volume of the rifle's reports in the long, narrow space made his ears squeal, but he continued raking the barrel of his weapon back and forth, shooting all the while, desperate to suppress the incoming gunfire. Red-hot ejected shell casings bounced around the floor all around him and ricocheted back into his face, while splinters of paneling pricked his eyes and covered his hair and clothing. It was clear to him by the incredible amount of gunfire that he was up against more than one weapon, perhaps as many as three. He emptied his AK and crawled for the other lying nearby, scooping it up. He continued firing, pushing himself along the floor with his feet and flattening himself even lower to the filthy linoleum as an incoming round punched a massive hole in the wall less than a foot above his head. Court jammed his Kalashnikov through the opening to return fire, again sweeping his muzzle back and forth. He had no idea who or what he was shooting at. His training and his years of experience commanded his actions now. He was in a fight for his life, and he did not pause to consider the consequences of each thumbnail-sized round he spent tearing through the wall at 2,300 feet per second. Finally, this second weapon clicked on an empty chamber, and he took a moment to just lie there and listen. His ears were battered enough from all the shooting, and the heavy music coming from another part of the house droned on, but he was reasonably sure the incoming fire had stopped. The woman moaned on the floor 10 feet away, but he ignored her as he climbed to one knee. Court dropped the rifle on the floor there next to him, and he heaved the sword. He stood back up and headed down the hall, hoping to make it to any more threats in the house before they had a chance to regroup and attack. When he reached the woman, he decided he needed to check her for any weapons. She had nothing on her other than a crack pipe, a thick roll of 20s, and a lighter. He saw her bloody thighs and determined from the location of the wounds that the arteries in her legs remained intact, and she would probably survive. He thought she was out of the fight completely, but before he could stand back up, she looked up to him, bared her teeth, and tried to scratch at his eyes with her fingernails. Court punched her in her left temple with the hilt of the sword, dazing her instantly. He then grabbed her by the waistband of her jeans in the small of her back, and he lifted her off the floor. He walked on, carrying her like a rag doll, holding the sword in his right hand as he dragged her along with his left. He found the stereo in the main living room and turned it off, and as soon as he did so, he heard the two men outside frantically beating on the boarded windows next to the front door, trying to get back in. He popped the disc out of the property's security camera system, and he snapped it in his hands and slipped it into his pocket. Then he turned and moved down a hall, out of the main living area. In a large back bedroom, his eyes settled on a scene of carnage. An older man, covered in Aryan Brotherhood ink like the others, lay on his back in the middle of the floor. His arms and legs were splayed. His head was split open from a gunshot wound to the eye. Court determined one of the 7.62 rounds he'd fired into the wall had passed all the way through the man's skull. The dead man's gore had been splattered across a faux leather recliner behind him that had itself taken a half dozen rounds of hate from Court's borrowed rifles. Next to the body lay an AK, And next to this, Court saw the bald-headed man he'd spoken to through the front door just minutes earlier. The Aryan Brotherhood meth dealer sat on the floor, leaning against the foot of an unmade bed, his eyes glazed, but pointing in Court's direction. The black polymer Kalashnikov lay in his lap, but his hands were resting on the floor. Court counted three gunshot wounds on the man, one in the right wrist, one in the left elbow, and another in his right hip. The bald-headed man's chest heaved up and down rapidly, and he was covered in blood. Court used the tip of the katana to flick the AK-47 out of the man's lap and beyond his reach. He then dragged the unconscious woman into the room and dropped her face first on the bed behind the injured man. The bald-headed man lay there motionless as Court did this, blood pumping from his hip and arms. Court looked the wounds over and didn't give the man much chance for survival unless the bleeding was controlled and paramedics made the scene in the next 15 minutes. Court looked around the room. All the walls, all the furniture, all the people, for that matter, were riddled with bullet holes. Court pulled a blanket off the bed. It was soiled and stained and covered in cigarette burns. He tossed it to the drug dealer on the floor. The man pressed it against his hip to stanch the bleeding, groaning with pain as he put pressure on the wound. He held it in place with his injured left arm.
"What do you want?"
"What do you think?"
"Drugs?"
"Guess again."
"Cash?"
"You're brighter than you look."
The white supremacist's voice slurred a little.
"You ain't getting shit."
Court checked his watch. A stray round here and there might not garner too much interest in Ward 8, but he knew the roar of a 30-second full-auto firefight would draw out the police, and he sure as hell did not want to be hanging out in this meth den when the cops showed up.
"I don't have time to dick around. I see from all that ink that you are no stranger to superficial wounds from sharp objects, so I'll have to go deep, won't I?"
Court raised the katana chest high, holding the hilt with both hands.
"What the fuck are you going to—"
The man stopped speaking suddenly, and his focus shifted to a point somewhere over Court's left shoulder. Court knew the man was looking at the doorway behind him. Without hesitation, Court flipped the sword around in his left hand and brought it underhanded back behind him, and he fired it back like a piston, launching it through the air blade first without looking. Immediately, he heard the steel strike flesh, and he turned around, saw a bearded man in the doorway 10 feet away, armed with a massive Desert Eagle pistol. The katana had caught him in the solar plexus, driven through his lungs, and the tip now rested against the backside of the man's ribcage. The big handgun fell from the man's hand, and he reached up for the sword for a short time, his wide eyes on it, his face a mask of confusion. After a moment, however, he folded down onto the floor, ending up with his back propped up on the doorframe, wheezing and grunting with the movement of his chest. His eyes went unfixed and glassy as he drifted away. Court knew the look of the dying. It didn't sadden him. He felt little other than operational concerns. He knelt over the dying man, rummaged through his pockets, pushed the man's weakening hands away when they reached out to stop him. Court found nothing of interest on the man, so he left him alone to die, and he turned back to the wounded drug dealer at the foot of the bed.
"I'm going to make this really quick and simple. Show me where the money is, and you get help before you bleed out."
The man looked at his two dead partners, back behind him to the unconscious woman on the bed, then back to Court.
"Go fuck yourself."
Court nodded, and he pulled the blanket out of the man's grasp. He looked down at the blood pumping from the man's hip.
3 minutes and you'll lose consciousness. 5 minutes, you're dead."
"I don't give a shit."
"Well, that makes two of us. I'll find the money anyway, or the cops will. Not that it will matter much to you, because you'll be in a fridge at the morgue."
Court saw the wheels spinning in the man's head. When he realized he would gain nothing from his obstinacy, he said,
"Windowsill, pop the ledge up."
Court tossed the bloody blanket back to the wounded drug dealer. Then he went to the boarded-up window. He yanked up the wooden sill. With some effort, it pulled away from the wall. Inside was a channel in the frame of the house. He could see two bags there, and he fished them out quickly with a metal coat hanger he found lying loose on the floor. The first paper bag contained a meth ball, a plastic bag holding small plastic baggies, each one containing a 1/16 of an ounce of crystal meth. Court wasn't sure what the street value of it all was, but there had to have been 100 or more bags. He turned and tossed the meth bag into the lap of the nearly decapitated corpse just feet away.
"Careful, this shit'll kill you," Court said, and then he looked in the second bag.
This one was stuffed with cash, tens and twenties mostly, but there were a few fives and even some ones. He held it up to the wounded man on the floor.
"How much?"
Even though he'd stanched the bulk of the blood flow, the man was weakening noticeably. Through gasps, he said,
"I don't know. About 13 grand. Little more, maybe."
The soft wail of distant sirens caused Court to pick up his pace now. He shoved the money in his coat pocket and began looking for guns. He counted 7 firearms in the house, but they were all wrong for his needs. The chrome-plated Desert Eagle pistol was as long as a shoebox and inefficiently heavy. He could get out of the area with the pistol if he hid it under his shirt, but he wouldn't be able to operate in the district with such a huge and flashy weapon. There were 4 AK-47-style semi-automatic rifles, none of which he could hide in his blazer to exfiltrate the scene with, even while folded. He loved AKs. He knew he couldn't go wrong with the venerable Russian assault rifle, but it was hardly a low-profile weapon. He also found 2 pistol-grip shotguns. The shotguns were like the Desert Eagle, almost small enough to get away with, but way too big to use efficiently in the manner Court had planned. He went back to the severely wounded man sitting up in front of the bed. He felt around his waistband, then frisked him down to his ankles, avoiding the blood on the man's clothing. Court breathed a sigh of relief when his fingers brushed against a Velcro ankle holster low on the man's right leg. He yanked out a tiny Ruger LCP-380. It carried 8 rounds of hollow-point ammo and fit nicely in the palm of Court's hand. The drug dealer hadn't resisted at all. Court wondered if the man had even remembered the weapon strapped to his leg. Court slipped the gun into the back pocket of his jeans, then walked over to a nightstand by the bed. It was covered with ashtrays, cigarette packs, crumpled beer cans, and candy wrappers, so Court used a forearm to knock every last item onto the floor. He was back there in the corner for several seconds, long enough to arouse the curiosity of the wounded drug dealer, who was now lying on his side on the floor in front of the bed.
"You got what you came for. There's nothing else."
When Court did not reply, the man spoke in a slurred voice.
"What the fuck are you doing?"
Court replied cryptically.
"Sending a message."
"What?"
Soon, Court headed for the door, passing the wounded man on the floor without a glance as he did so. As he started up the hall, the wounded man called out from behind.
"Who are you?"
Court did not reply. He wouldn't give the man or his buddies, alive or dead, another moment's thought. His plans ahead were infinitely more important than these inconsequential street criminals. They were just a means to an end, nothing more. Less than a minute before the first police car stopped in front of the house, Court stepped back out into the backyard, holding a loaded AK-47 high in front of him. He realized quickly the 2 Aryan Brotherhood men who had been out there were gone from the scene. Even their damn dog had hit the road with the sound of approaching sirens. So Court tossed the AK into the grass, climbed up onto the Monte Carlo by the fence, carefully pushed the barbed wire out of the way, and dropped into an adjoining backyard. He was out of the neighborhood 2 minutes after that. Tonight had been more trouble than he'd envisioned, but it had all been a necessary opening move in his operation. He needed a portable and concealable weapon, and he needed capital to put his plan into action. He wanted more gun than what was now sitting in the back pocket of his jeans. To be sure, he wasn't going to fight much of a battle here in the U.S. with the little Ruger, but it was a decent tool, and with it, he had improved his defenses markedly. But infinitely more important than the gun was the cash. This was America, after all, and cash was king. And with 13 grand, Court Gentry could wage a motherfucking war. Chapter 7. By the time the meeting on the 7th floor of CIA's old headquarters building hit the 45-minute mark, Suzanne Brewer was reasonably certain everyone else had forgotten she was still here. Denny had admitted her into the Violator working group, true, but since then she had sat to the side, seemingly excluded from the conversation. The crosstalk was now between Jordan Mays and Denny Carmichael as they discussed moving Joint Special Operations Command operatives into the city. Apparently a quasi-legal precedent had been established for doing so, which came as a surprise to Brewer. It seemed clear that even though Carmichael wasn't concerned about doing things by the book himself, he knew JSOC wouldn't operate without all the forms filled out to the letter. So he was making sure the CIA's JSOC liaison had all the details he needed to contact Fort Bragg and get the highly trained paramilitaries on the way to D.C. Brewer found herself impressed with Denny. She'd never worked closely with him before, and knew him mostly as the old hard piece of shoe leather in a suit that she saw in the halls every now and then. She did know that Carmichael commanded a take-no-prisoners reputation in the agency, and his colleagues knew to fall into step behind the man, or to get the hell out of his way, because although he and the director weren't close, Denny got things done, and clearly the president liked having a stone-cold killing machine like Carmichael in his bag of tricks. Now, Carmichael, Mays, and the communications officer at the table began discussing the logistics of initiating a full-time Violator Working Group Tactical Operations Center, or TOC, on the 4th floor. Carmichael had already said he wanted more boots on the ground, so Mays ordered 30 contracted assets with security clearance from a private security company. These assets and the JSOC operators would need a central ops center to coordinate their movements and responsibilities, and the TOC would serve that function. Suzanne Brewer was surprised they wouldn't use Special Activities Division assets for this, but Denny was adamant he didn't want SAD men operating on the streets of D.C. It seemed like an odd quibble for a man who just ordered up U.S. military forces and private contractors to do the same thing, but Brewer figured there was a piece of the puzzle she didn't understand, so she didn't bring it up. When there was a brief lull in the chatter, Brewer fought her way back into the conversation.
I'd like to know something about Violator's specific capabilities.
With Carmichael's approval, Mays said,
Gentry has every tactic, every piece of tradecraft, every relevant training evolution you can think of. He can fly planes, scuba, rappel, fast rope, and free climb. He's a master in the Israeli martial art of Krav Maga, and he's the best close-quarters battle tactician to ever serve in SAD. He's been to jump school, sniper school, advanced surveillance school, explosive breaching school, SEER school.
Suzanne didn't know that one.
SEER school?
Survival, evasion, resistance, and escape.
Okay,
Mays continued.
Ground Branch contains the finest 150 hard assets on planet Earth. Gentry was as good as any one of them, if not better. And that was before he went solo 5 years ago and really began to hone his craft.
Brewer asked,
When you say hard asset, I assume Gentry was involved in lethal operations for the agency?
No one answered for a moment. Brewer cleared her throat.
Look, you invited me in. If I can't be told the full scope of the danger, then I won't be much help to you.
Carmichael nodded almost imperceptibly, and Jordan Mays said,
Gentry began his career as a singleton operator. He graduated to singleton assassin, and then in the Gulf Sierra Task Force, he was the point man for an assassination and rendition team.
Mays cleared his throat.
Gulf Sierra was absolute tip-of-the-spear stuff.
Brewer took it all in. The gravity of what was being asked of her was growing by the second.
I spoke of the rumors I had heard. As a private hitman, he supposedly has executed over 30 lethal operations.
Mays answered back.
Our confirmed number is much lower, 12.
A large discrepancy,
Brewer added.
But the fact remains he has managed to survive for a long time in that industry. My suggestion is we don't play into this threat. If he draws us out into a campaign on the streets of the USA, we will be vulnerable to counterattack as well as exposure.
Carmichael shook his head adamantly.
Suzanne, we are going after him. We know he's in the area. We have no intentions of battening down the hatches and sheltering in place while he is here. I've been after this man for 5 years. This is an opportunity too good to pass up. I'm not going to just lock my doors and wait for him to move on.
Brewer had expected this reaction.
Very well. In that case, we need to bring in a brain trust to help us determine Gentry's potential actions. Who in the agency knows him best? Who knows all of his TTPs?
She knew the tactics, techniques, and procedures of her target were an essential element in establishing his operational pattern, which itself was critical in figuring out what he would do next. The NSA liaison spoke up.
Matthew Hanley at SAD knows him well. He ran Gentry and the Gulf Sierra Task Force.
More to himself than to the others, Denny Carmichael said,
I don't trust Hanley. He's after my job.
Brewer smiled. Taking a chance with a joke, she said,
I'm after your job, Denny.
There were a few chuckles at the table, but not from Carmichael. He sniffed.
You can fucking have it today.
Mays joined Brewer in making a case for bringing Hanley into the working group.
Court Gentry shot Matt Hanley in Mexico City a couple of years ago. He barely survived. Matt might not be your closest confidant in the halls here at Langley, but I feel sure he wants Gentry's head on a pike as bad as you do. Isn't that all that matters at the moment?
Brewer knew Matt Hanley, vaguely. She'd met him in Port-au-Prince when he was chief of the CIA station there, but had heard nothing about him being shot. Protecting CIA facilities and personnel was Brewer's job, so she couldn't believe she'd been kept out of the loop on something so big.
Wait, the head of SAD was shot by the gray man?
She caught herself.
Violator, I mean.
Carmichael said,
Hanley wasn't running SAD at the time. He was COS in Haiti. It was kept quiet.
From me?
From everyone.
Carmichael drummed his fingers on the table for a moment.
I don't want Hanley brought in. He stays on the outside of this. For now, anyway.
Brewer said,
If you don't want him involved in this hunt, that's one thing, but if Violator has a beef with the agency, that beef is likely to include his former case officer, especially if he's targeted him in the past. We surely need to give Hanley a heads up that his rogue operative is on the loose in the area.
Carmichael seemed to acquiesce a little.
We'll put security on Hanley, watching his house, just to keep him safe. But let's keep it low-key. Don't tell Hanley.
Brewer dropped the subject and went back to her request for information from others who knew Gentry.
Who else worked with him? What about other members of his task force?
The CIA liaison to JSOC said,
All dead. Gentry killed them.
Mays and Carmichael exchanged another look. The liaison caught it, and he cocked his head.
What?
Carmichael said,
Not exactly true. One man survived.
Mays picked it up from there.
The team leader of Task Force Golf Sierra, Zachary Hightower, is not dead.
With a shrug, he said,
He might as well be. Denny shit-canned him after he botched an attempt to snatch Gentry in Africa.
Brewer said,
It stands to reason his team leader would know a great deal about his operational abilities. Do we know where he is?
Mays said,
No idea, but I'm sure he can be located.
Carmichael held up a finger.
I want to see him first, face to face, to evaluate what I'm working with. He was injured severely in Africa, then he was drummed out of the agency. If he's like a lot of operators, he'll be bitter, and a shell of the man he was when he worked for us.
Brewer nodded and made notes on her pad. She started to switch the conversation to Carmichael's immediate physical security, but one of the communications technicians outside the room knocked on the glass wall and stepped to the door. Mays pressed a button and the door unlocked with a click. Mays asked, "What is it?"
"We picked up something on the scanner. PD reports a homicide in Washington Highlands. Home invasion, multiple fatalities."
Carmichael picked up his coffee mug and took a sip.
"Sounds like any other Saturday night over there."
"A surviving victim reports a lone Caucasian assailant. Apparently he took down a house full of heavily armed Aryan Brotherhood drug dealers. 2 dead, 4 wounded."
"When?"
"Less than 30 minutes ago."
"One guy did it?" Carmichael asked.
"Yes, sir."
Carmichael and Mays nodded at each other, and Brewer picked up what her superiors were thinking. She asked,
"Why would Violator attack a house full of meth dealers?"
Carmichael said immediately,
"Maybe he needs something."
"He needs meth?"
Mays answered with confidence.
"Resources, arms, and financing. No better place to get both if you don't mind a fight."
Carmichael said,
"And Violator loves a fight."
Slowly, his lean face widened into a smile.
"It's classic gentry, isn't it?"
Brewer was confused.
"Classic in what way?"
"He needs weapons and money, right?" Carmichael said. "What's the easiest way to acquire them? Knock over a pawn shop? Hit a liquor store with a security guard? Why doesn't he steal a shotgun out of a patrolled car and rob a check-cashing business? Why does he do it the hard way? Hit right up the fucking middle of a house full of armed meth-head Aryan assholes?"
"Tell me why," Brewer said.
Mays understood what Carmichael was getting at, and he answered Brewer's question.
"Because Violator sees himself as the good guy. He only targets bad guys."
"But you just said you think he is a threat to us."
"Make no mistake. He truly thinks he's some sort of hero, and we're the villains."
Jordan Mays stood now.
"I'll check out the crime scene personally."
Suzanne Brewer stood as well.
"Denny, I'd like to go along, too. I'm behind the curve on understanding this target of ours. If this was him, I want to get the feel of the scene, to see what he's capable of."
"Okay."
Carmichael turned his attention to A.D. Mays.
"Mays, it's possible you are in Gentry's crosshairs, same as me. I want you rolling in armor with a full detail."
Mays whistled softly.
"Damn, Denny, I didn't even have a full security detail in Baghdad. Gentry was on our side back then, wasn't he?"
Chapter 8. After dark, Andy Scholl lived on cans of Red Bull and cups of convenience store coffee. He wasn't a night owl by design, but over time, he had created a chemically structured, superhuman version of himself that got him through the nighttime hours, allowing him to excel at his job as a crime reporter for the Washington Post. As on as he was when most people were tucked away in their beds, there was a price to be paid. The physical crash came each day with dawn. He was usually back in his apartment in Arlington by 8 and asleep by 9, but by 4:30 p.m., he was on his way back to his tiny cubicle in the Post's office on 15th Street Northwest, just a few blocks from the White House. He told himself he wouldn't have to do this forever. Andy was ambitious, and he was 4 years into his 5-year plan to get out of Metro and into something higher profile, a position on the national desk, or on an investigative team that wouldn't necessitate him being a zombie every damn day. So, he worked hard, he got along with his editor, and he didn't bitch. All that taken into account, Andy still figured he must be doing something seriously wrong, because why else was he the one driving out to the shittiest ward in the district in the middle of this cold, misty night to report on a double homicide? Tonight's assignment didn't sound terribly interesting. The Watergate break-in, this wasn't. From the info he picked up over the police scanner in his car, it seemed to be a shooting at a crack house or something. Not anything new and exciting, as Andy had filed countless stories like this already,
But there were bodies, and there were injured, and this was his job. So, as soon as he finished a piece he was working on at his desk, he climbed into his Ford Festiva and headed out into the dreary night. With luck, he told himself, he could get 6 column inches out of this shooting. Now he followed the last instructions of his GPS and turned off 4th Street Southeast and onto Brandywine Street. Even though he knew the depressing crime statistics for Ward 8, Andy never really felt unsafe around here. He was from Philly and had been raised lower middle class, so he was no stranger to rough streets. He'd been mugged once in D.C., but that was just 3.5 blocks from the Capitol building, so he didn't describe much more threat to the so-called bad parts of town. As Andy pulled into the neighborhood, he heard over his police scanner the crime scene was a possible meth stash house run by the Aryan Brotherhood, and as he parked and looked around, he thought that possibility to be highly likely. He couldn't imagine this property in front of him being anything other than a drug house. It was basically a boarded-up ramshackle single story with a pickup truck adorned with a rebel flag decal in the driveway out front. The front door was a big black iron monstrosity, and the fence around the back of the property was high and ringed with barbed wire. The entire property was surrounded by police tape, and a few locals stood around in the rainy night. In the street, a dozen squad cars idled, all with their headlights facing the home, and many with their lights flashing. A pair of fire trucks were parked end-to-end out front, and a single ambulance sat in the driveway, the EMTs leaning against their vehicle. Just another night. Other than animal control wrangling a big pit bull in the parking lot of an apartment building 3 doors down, there was no sense of urgency to the scene, which told Andy this ambulance was here to pick up dead bodies, not injured victims. As he parked, he noticed a gray 4-door Nissan that he knew belonged to a homicide detective he'd become friendly with during his time as a cop's reporter. He grabbed his backpack, stuffed with the camera, notebooks, an iPad, and a digital recorder, and he climbed out of his car, locking it before heading across the street. He'd gotten less than halfway to the police tape when a patrolman standing at the perimeter shone a flashlight in his face. The light clicked off quickly, and Andy recognized the burly black officer.
"How's it going, Mike?"
The cop held up his hand and said,
"Not yet, Andy."
Andy stopped in the street.
"What's that?"
"Can't let you in just yet."
"Really?"
They always let Andy in, or at least up to the porch to take a quick peek.
"Why not?"
"Don't know."
"Who's the detective in charge? Is it Roush? Tell him I'm here. He always lets me poke a head in. Won't take but a minute."
"Roush isn't in there."
"Why are you breaking my balls tonight, Mike? I saw his Altima back there."
"Roush is around, but not in the house. Hasn't been inside yet. I think he's on a canvas. Go talk to him."
"What's he doing on a canvas if he hasn't even looked at the scene yet?"
The cop did not answer. He looked a bit uncomfortable, but he also looked resolute. Andy knew he could whine about it a little more, but he also knew he wasn't getting in that house right now. He noticed a flashlight's beam shining through a small opening in a boarded-up front window. There was definitely someone inside.
"What's going on?"
he asked. Mike turned away.
"Man, go talk to Roush."
Andy found Detective Roush 5 minutes later, a half block away, stepping down from the stoop of a duplex. From the look of him, he hadn't gotten any good information from anyone inside.
"Hey, Bobby, how's your night going?"
Bobby Roush was a wiry, thin, and balding 50-year-old who always looked like he needed a sandwich more than he needed the cigarettes he constantly smoked. He kept walking as he said,
"It's going, Shoal. How come you're not over there at the murder? Seen 10,000, seen 'em all?"
Roush took the young reporter by the arm and turned him away from the duplex, and together they started walking up the sidewalk towards the house next door. He said,
"Do me a favor and go back over the river. Come back in the morning."
Andy looked at his watch. In a tone that was much more good-natured than smart-ass, he said,
12:58 a.m. It's morning. Here I am."
Roush sighed.
"Sorry, but I can't let you get any closer to that scene." "What's the deal? You got a dead celeb in there or something?
Andy half chuckled as he said it, but he turned quickly serious when he saw Detective Rausch just give him an uncomfortable look.
Oh, man.
Andy got excited quickly. The prospect of this being a real story made him salivate.
Like a congressman's kid? Who is it?
Rausch shook his head.
Nah, nothing like that. Just some white trash dealers, from what they tell me.
Then what the hell is going on? Rausch stopped walking in the dark, and he leaned in closer, causing Andy to recoil at first. Quickly, the Post reporter realized the detective wanted to whisper something. As weird as this was, Andy leaned in himself. Rausch said,
"Spooks."
"Come again?"
"There's a bunch of spooks in there. They won't let us in there till they are finished looking around."
"What do you mean, spooks? Like CIA?
Rausch shrugged. "They didn't say that, but I was Army, and they aren't military intel. I ran into a few CIA when I was working Vice. A couple of guys in trench coats show up, not spit-shined like bureau types, more scotch breath and chewed fingernails. They flash some general-looking Homeland Security credos and push past the PD like they own the fucking place. Same deal tonight, except one of the guys is a serious-looking woman in a trench coat."
Rausch shrugged his narrow shoulders inside his raincoat.
"They're definitely spooks."
Rausch turned and looked back at the house, and Andy did the same, taking in the dilapidated property from a distance.
"This isn't exactly Embassy Row," Andy said. "What are they doing here?"
Rausch lit a cigarette, shielding the flame from the misty breeze.
"In true spook fashion, they didn't volunteer much information about their motives."
"What else do you know?"
"Just what the responding officers and the EMTs said. Two DOA, one with his head blown half off from a rifle, the other skewered with some kind of ninja sword."
"Damn. And the injured?"
"They transported four to MedStar Trauma. All Aryan Brotherhood. One dude took three AK rounds, another's got a busted face, a third has a concussion and possible neck trauma, and some skank took two to the legs. I'll go interview them as soon as I'm allowed in to see my crime scene."
The annoyance was evident in Rausch's voice.
"On the scanner they said it was one guy who did all this." "That's what the injured woman told the responding officers."
Andy thought for a second. This story was starting to get interesting.
"How about I wait at the tape so I can talk to the CIA guys when they come out?"
Rausch looked at Andy for an instant, then he shut down, like he just realized jawing with the reporter was the wrong call.
"Look, I didn't say CIA. You did. I said they were Homeland Security. Do me a favor and get out of here till they leave. Come back in the morning."
Rausch tossed his cigarette in the gutter and headed up to knock on the next door. Andy walked back to his car, then he stood there for a few minutes looking at the scene, awash in flashing red and blue lights. Finally, one of the beat cops stepped up and asked him if he wouldn't mind backing off a block or two. Normally, Andy would have told the man to kiss his ass, but not this time. He climbed in his Ford, then drove around the corner, parked, and got back out with his camera. He walked between a pair of apartment buildings, squinted out the reflections of flashing lights, and made his way one block north of the crime scene. On the street in front of him were two black Chevy Suburbans that clearly didn't belong. Drivers sat behind the wheels, and each vehicle had a passenger in the front. Andy stopped in his tracks before the men saw him, then he retraced his steps back to the apartment buildings. Under a stairwell, he found a place in the dark where he could keep his eyes on the vehicles, and there he waited. 10 minutes later, several figures in overcoats approached the Suburbans. One was a white-haired man in his early 50s, flanked by a pair of men Andy took immediately for bodyguards. Next to him was a woman in her 30s, wearing eyeglasses, with her brown hair in a professional-looking bun. He snapped several pictures of both of them before they drove off, careful not to use his flash. Back in his Fiesta, he looked at the images on the digital display of his camera. He hadn't expected to recognize either of them, even on closer inspection, and he did not. But he knew someone who might. Sitting there in the shittiest part of the city, Andy looked up a number on his contact list and made a call. A few miles west in Georgetown, a 54-year-old woman slowly reached for the vibrating mobile phone on her nightstand. While doing so, she blinked the sleep from her eyes and checked the time on the phone screen. It was 1:15.